I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the London Review of Books podcast. I'm Thomas Jones. This week I'm talking to Laleh Khalili, a professor of Gulf Studies at Exeter University, whose most recent book is Sinews of War and Trade, Shipping and Capitalism in the Arabian Peninsula. Her most recent piece for the LRB takes a steely look at the development finance industry, which is caricatured by its right-wing opponents as woke capital, and is epitomised by the figure of Arif Naqvi, a private equity multimillionaire and ardent global free marketeer. The piece is a review of three books: The Key Man, How the Global Elite Was Duped by a Capitalist Fairy Tale by Simon Clark and Will Lauch; Icarus, The Life and Death of the Abraj Group by Brian Brivati; and Our Lives in Their Portfolios, Why Asset Managers Own the World by Brett Christophers. Hello, Laleh, and thank you very much for joining me again.
Hello, Tom. Nice to see you.
So before we get into the particulars of Arif Naqvi's case, perhaps we could talk a bit about this idea of, in inverted commas, woke capital. Is it a real thing, or is the idea of capital being put to work in the interests of social justice an illusion, or even a contradiction in terms?
I would say it's a contradiction in terms, depending on how you define social justice. So I think it's important to start by saying that the title woke capital, I don't buy into the idea that somehow there is such a thing as woke capital and then there's unwoke or regular mainstream capital. I think Quinn Slobodian recently just put out an article somewhere where he was talking about different sectors or different segments of capital that take different positionalities towards the way in which capital is supposed to work in the rest of the world. And he specifically uses the case, I think, of steel capital and the fact that the steel business, the steel industry in the US, takes a position that is very supposedly anti-woke. As would, for example, I would imagine coal or oil would take those positions. And what makes them unwoke is the fact that they are industrial industries. They're very much against internationalization of capital, or at least they're very much against their turf being internationalized by capital. They're quite happy for example, for American businesses to go elsewhere. And they deploy a kind of a nationalist language in order to protect their turf, protect their bases and spaces and milieus of accumulation of capital. And then the term woke capital has emerged. And as I explain in the piece, it covers all manners of sin in the minds of those people who like to call it that. And it goes from, for example, capital being put to use in social goods, allocation of social goods, to, for example, capital or capitalist businesses doing things for their employees, which the right wingers look down upon. So doing things for their women employees or doing things for their gay employees or trans employees. And so that's also called woke capital. And this kind of a contention between these sectors of capital, which is, you know, strongly nationalizing versus an internationalizing capital that tries to appeal to the sort of the liberal sentiments of the consumer base, and or make money through areas which are considered to be usually some form of social good, for example, healthcare. This contention is at the heart of the naming of some capitalist woke capital. I don't buy into that terminology, but I do think it is interesting that RF Nahvi's businesses would have, for example, have gotten that moniker when Nahvi was a capitalist par excellence, whose aim really was to make money for himself and for the investors in his funds. And if it had a sheen of do-gooding, then all the better.
Yeah, I mean, we should perhaps say that the use of the term woke, the way it's used sarcastically as a term of contempt by the right wing, I mean, that use of the word is itself an act of racist appropriation, isn't it? Because woke is
absolutely.
You know, there are recordings of Ledbetter using the word in, you know, the 1930s. It's a African American vernacular term that's being
and meaning, in fact. Yeah. Black American theorists who say essentially the use of woke by a lot of the right wingers is where they in another occasion they would have used the N-word. Now they can't use the N-word and so they use woke. And in fact, if you actually in your mind you do that little switch whenever you read the term woke capital, it becomes clear that it's actually not too far off, because of course the use of the N-word was also went hand in hand with sort of natalist protectionist towards, you know, white natalist kind of policies. So very much, it very much had the racist and racializing impulse, very much had a gender element to it too. And so you find that terminology that is being used right now to apply to both questions of gender and race definitely and entirely fits in a long line of racist terms that have been used across, you know, the 20th century, in order to isolate, mock, and devalue certain forms of speaking, thinking, writing, etc.
So perhaps using a different terminology, there is an argument against the do-gooding businesses, or as you call them, or businesses which appear to be doing good from the left. Or one argument which uses instead terms such as greenwashing or pinkwashing, the point being that what the right sees as a capitulation to wokeness is a facade for rapacious business as usual.
Yes. I mean, I think there is a huge element of that. I mean, if one goes to, for example, any pride parade in any of the big cities in Europe or North America, you see an element of this pink washing where if every single corporation is printing out, you know, rainbow flags and is desperately trying to have a presence there. That's, you know, from the extremely cynical uses of a kind of a righteous front. To actually things that do benefit, you know, their employees, for example. So Apple, the big corporation, you know, whose factories in Asia and elsewhere are exploitative nightmares, nevertheless was one of the first companies in the US, for example, to extend healthcare and other kinds of employee benefits to its to the gay partners of its employees. So, and I think what is really interesting is that all of this, whether it's a cynical, you know, uses of the queer people or women or whatever, all the way to providing services to their employees, which you would expect that they do so in order to keep their employees happy, is then lumped together as some kind of something that the right wing criticizes. But I think it's also important to recognize for us that come from the left and are doing a critique of this, is that there is always self-interest at stake here. It's not that capital is do-gooding in any way whatsoever. It is that there is a benefit to doing what it needs to do. Everything from, as you know, from, as I said, ensuring that they get the best of their employees by providing them with the absolute best perks that they can, to using those symbols that benefits them, so that the rainbow flag, because they know their consumer base is actually quite amenable to that, all the way to things like, for example, portraying the best of the athletes in their advertisement, as Nike does. And so many of the best athletes, okay, happen to be either women or black or whatever. And so that also is, again, it's advertising. So it's important for us on the left to recognize that there is an impulse of self-interest in there. It's not about altruism. It's not about do-gooding. It really is about another means of extracting value from images, from discourses, from words, from representations that benefit them, because the market likes it, because the consumers, citizenry, people, those who have money to spend like this stuff.
But I suppose if we're to separate for a moment the intentions from consequences, that you can still say that they're doing it to make money. But if the one of the consequences is that people in America who otherwise wouldn't have health insurance or good dental insurance do, then that is a good thing. In a small way. I mean, there's obviously the larger question of, well, why doesn't everyone get free dental care anyway? But given that that's a very long way off, these ameliorative effects are a good thing.
I think it's important to acknowledge that. I mean, I'm not so much of a sort of a Stalinist to say, no, absolutely, everybody has to have, you know, their teeth falling out of their heads, waiting for the moment at which the utopia of free dental care for everybody arrives. I do think that these ameliorative factors are really quite important. But I also do think that at the same time, the effect of those is that they establish and reproduce a kind of a discourse, which I think is really important to recognize. Or a kind of a vibe, if you will, in which the effort to actually struggle for free healthcare for everybody, let's set aside dental care, which was one of the first things Margaret Thatcher got rid of in this country, free healthcare it should be a right, should be a basic right of everybody. It is simply, I mean, it's the only way that we're all going to survive, right? And so I think that in a sense, that the ameliorative effect is important in the short term, but its long-term effect could be that it actually makes it very much more difficult to arrive at a public that is struggling for, that is mobilizing for, and that is willing to fight for a public good that should be publicly funded and that should be available to everybody, regardless of whether or not they're employed by a nice employer or not.
Exactly. So how does the rise and the fall of Arif Naqvi relate to all of this?
Arif Naqvi is a really interesting character. And I think that this comes across in the two books written about him. The Clark and Lauch book certainly goes into a great deal of detail about what kind of a background he's had. And of course, it doesn't stint on explaining how clever he is and what a good deal maker he is. One of the things that everybody keeps mentioning, and I did a bunch of research on Naqvi, beyond sort of the two books that I read. And one of the things that everybody keeps mentioning, absolutely everybody who ever interviewed him in his, you know, in the years in which he was being feted by all the business magazines and journals, is the fact that, for example, he, in the grammar school he went to in Pakistan, he picked up on Shakespeare, and he can recite entire passages of Shakespeare from the heart. And in fact, it's something that he does a little bit competitively, but with a great deal of pride. And I think in part it is because he is Shakespearean in his ambitions. He's a larger than life character, and that comes across in all of the books. And I think in some senses those larger than life characters, particularly coming from the background he is, and then sort of making it through the ranks of capital to sit on the stage of World Economic Forum, so that to the elite of the global capital, requires that kind of a Shakespearean ambitions, unscrupulousness, and intelligence, actually. And if not intelligence in the sense of book smart, but in the sense of being able to read a situation and being able to have a kind of a business sense about things, or at least to be able to get people to buy into your business sense. I'm here thinking of Elon Musk, who in his management of Twitter has proven himself deeply stupid, but nevertheless, he seems to have a kind of a business intelligence that allows for banks to keep bankrolling his businesses. So I think that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about here. But NACVI actually does seem like an interesting book smart kind of figure as well. He seems well read. He seems really interesting. And what he started off was essentially by being a very good deal maker. And he was advised to go into private equity because that is where your good deal making abilities and your sort of foresight in being able to see what is coming into the future could actually benefit you greatly, but also benefit your investors. So what private equity is, and I think I should probably explain this just in case your readers haven't read this. Private equity is essentially a set of funds in which a bunch of private investors invest money. The reason that the private investment element matters is because when you have private investors investing money rather than a fund going to the public, i.e. being listed in a stock market, is that the requirements for reporting are far less stringent. So if you have a company that is listed on the London Stock Exchange or the New York Stock Exchange, there are financial authorities in these countries which require you to every year you report on what you've spent money on. There are regulations around, for example, the pays of your CEOs and others. And there are all sorts of other forms of scrutiny that happens that shareholders do. There are annual audits by big audit companies which need to be public. Whereas if you have private equity, the privacy of that investment essentially insulates the companies from further outside scrutiny, whether that is by the SEC or various other financial authorities in a country or by financial reporters. And so private equity is something that has emerged really, it started emerging in the 1980s. Gordon Gekko in Wall Street was a private equity guy. KKR, which is very famous, was one of the first private equity businesses. Michael Milken was a private equity guy. And what these guys, Michael Milken, who was done in for fraud. And what these guys sort of get engaged in was they collected funds, they set up funds in which investors poured money, and then they used these funds to invest in businesses that weren't functioning too well. And they quote unquote turned them around. Now, what the turning around of these businesses often meant was that you sort of broke these businesses for part. You very often, or the vast majority of the time, let go of huge numbers of the employees. You cut off a whole lot of different kinds of functions of that business. And then you sold it on for a great deal of profit because of course, the ways in which corporate pricing is established is a kind of a magic, right? It is a self-reinforcing, self-reproducing system where analysts tell you how much something is worth on the basis of how it looks. So if you've cut off a bunch of employees, that is part of sort of the Bible of good capitalist management. If you have reduced the payroll, then you must be a really good manager. And therefore, that gives you a little gold star. Therefore, the analysts give you a better rating. Therefore, you're valued better. I mean, I'm simplifying and caricaturing. But basically, this is not too far off from the kind of process that happens. And a lot of the private equity investors tend to take investments from big hedge funds. Now, hedge funds often are things like our pension funds, and they tend to have a lot of liquidity, a lot of cash that they can invest. And so they, a lot of the time, give this money to the hedge funds, and the hedge funds use them. So in a way, our pensions we end up being invested in a process that is rapacious, even in the spectrum of capitalist rapacity. So because it is so ruthless, because it does require cutting off employees, because it does mean, entire functions are cut off and businesses are broken up. And Naqvi entered this business. He was very, even when he wasn't a very famous person, he was very capable of bringing in lots of money from different kinds of investors. People trusted him. He was able to get local regional investors, some of the ruling families, some of the Middle East capitalists to invest in his funds. And he essentially went in on lots of businesses where he went in, for example, to Spinney's grocery stores. And what was interesting for me reading the books that I was reading was that I was coming at a lot of the stories that were appearing in these books from a Middle East remembrance, memories of the kinds of events. So, for example, he bought Spinney's, which was a big grocery store across the Middle East, and he made it much more efficient and he divided it into bits. What I remember is that about 10, 15 years ago in Beirut, there were huge attempts by Spinney's workers to mobilize, and the union organizers were being fired like wholesale. And so there's an element of the story that is not often appear in thinking about how private equity turns businesses around, which is what happens to the employees of those businesses. So Naqvi's begins with Spinney's, does a really good job with a logistics company called Aramex, which is Jordanian, and then buys Karachi Electric, which is a utilities company in Karachi, which was having a lot of problems because it wasn't producing electricity. And Karachi Electric was one of the reasons for his downfall, or at least in the story that Brian Bravatti says, it is the reason for his downfall. But he also, towards the end of his the high-flying bits of his career, he was also collecting funds to invest in hospitals and other kinds of healthcare in Africa, the whole continent of Africa. And what he was doing was essentially he was looking at a continent in which there was a young population, growing economies. There was major economic processes that were taking place with China coming in and engaged in extractive industries. Their banks growing, essentially proliferating throughout the continent. Essentially, there is a population that is growing and it has disposable income, and therefore often a lot of that disposable income is spent on healthcare. And so healthcare is actually very good business. It's a huge business, in fact. And we've seen that with COVID also. And so he decides to invest in healthcare. And so another story, so it's not Karachi Electric only that results in his downfall, but it's also his investments in these health industries. And if you want, I can go into more detail about those.
So how did it all come crashing down? What brought Arif Naqvi's capitalist fairy tale to an end?
So what's interesting, and one of the reasons why it was, for me, quite useful to actually review two different accounts of his downfall, is that there is some disagreement as to what the downfall was all about. So I'll start with the financial journalists who actually have done a huge amount of research on this and interviewed tons of people about this. And their account is that the healthcare funds that Naqvi set up in order to invest in hospitals and various other healthcare infrastructures in Iraq had a huge amount of apparently investments from the Gates Foundation. We know that Bill and Melinda Gates' foundation at that stage was investing quite a bit in healthcare in Africa and was very involved in setting up various programs there. Now, of course, there are loads of people that are critical of the ways in which the Gates Foundation priorities reshape African healthcare in ways that are not necessarily beneficial to Africans themselves and which don't necessarily address the most urgent healthcare issues there, and that the Gates Foundation is crucially and centrally involved in the privatization of this public good there. Setting all of that aside, a fund manager within the Gates Foundation actually notices that this is the account that Clark and Lauch tell us about the downfall of NAGWE is that when this particular fund manager for the Gates Foundation begins to look into the numbers of NAGWE's healthcare funds, he notices that there is no necessary correlation between the amount that NAGWE's private equity abroad claims to be investing and actual infrastructures being built there. So what Clark and Lauch argue is that when more digging is done, it becomes clear that NAGWE is lifting money out of the funds for his own personal expenditures, and that he is also overvaluing the values of his funds, which is considered to be fraudulent. It's considered to be conning your investors. Okay, so that's one story. The second story that Brian Bravatti tells, and which is much more geopolitical rather than a story of, say, corruption or bad behavior or bad management, is that when NAGWE invested in Karachi Electric, like any good private equity guy, he intended to get this Karachi Electric to be profitable. And he did this by slashing hundreds of workers from the payrolls of Karachi Electric, resulted in massive riots in Karachi, etc. But this was a sign of good management because obviously it turned Karachi Electric around to some extent. And at that point, Shanghai Electric wanted to come and buy Karachi Electric. And Brian Bravatti claims that Shanghai Electric coming in to Pakistan at the height of CPEC, the relationship between China and Pakistan economic corridor, or being established, was against U.S. national interests, and therefore the U.S. foiled this, and the foiling of the sale of Karachi Electric meant that NAGWE's funds were bound up in something when he needed it, and therefore this all resulted in the downfall of NAGWE's abroad. Now, the problem with both of these stories is that they take the facts as knowable. They take certain things as being evidence of good management. For example, slashing workers at Karachi Electric being evidence of good management. And they both understand that what the problem with the private equity was that the elements that its funding was tied up in particular places where it couldn't be spent. But the problem is with both of these stories is, of course, that the basis by which NAGWE's work is judged is not what has happened to the little people, but rather what has happened to the investors, right? So that's the first thing. And whether that's fraud or not, whatever. The second thing is that Clark and Lauch put a lot of, as well as obviously the US prosecutors that are going after NAGWE, put a lot of stock by the fact that NAGWE overvalued his companies and his funds. And that to me is really interesting, because the overvaluation of your funds when everything is private, when there's no real proper audit, where even when you have a proper audit for a public company, you can fudge your numbers in such a way that values look higher than what they are, because you can change your impairment values, you can change your future values, so much of this valuation process is actually kind of a magic, if you will, or so much of it is actually, if we want to put it in a slightly more scientific sense, is what Donald McKenzie, the great economic sociologist, calls that this process is more an engine, not a camera, that valuation doesn't take a picture of something, that it actually creates, feeds into that process.
So if everyone agrees that something has a value, then it has that value.
Then it has that value.
But as soon as people start questioning that, that belief falls apart.
Exactly. This is good old Uncle Charlie's use value versus exchange value stuff, right? So there's an element of this that to me, I think, needs to be better highlighted. Okay, so let's say that this valuation process is such that it appears that NAGWE is overvaluing this result. result in charges of fraud being brought against them. Because people begin to withdraw their money out of the funds, he writes checks he cannot cash. And this actually is a very big deal in Dubai. His charges are brought for fraud, for bounced checks against him in Dubai. And charges of fraud are brought against them in US courts, which then, you know, results in extradition demands to Britain. And he is now in the final stages of an appeal against being sent to the US. He's under house arrest, has, you know, posted a massive bail, had to sell this massive estate he had in the Cotswolds or Oxfordshire in order to fund his bail. And he's living in his really posh gated mansion flat in Knightsbridge, awaiting to hear what is going to happen to him.
I mean, is his downfall, his ongoing downfall, I mean, is that all grist to the mill of the right-wing view of woke capital? That
I think in a way it is grist to the mill of the racists that believe that capitalists oversee are corrupt, whereas our capitalists are just hardworking and very good at what they do. That's, I think, one of the ways in which it's grist to the mill of baddies, if you will. I think the people that bang on about woke capital don't even know most of the time what private equity is. And most of the time, they won't know who Arif Naqvi was. If you said to them that he was investing in healthcare funds in Africa, they would probably ask what sort of a fund it was, and you know, and take his do-gooding statements as evidence of his wokeness. But they wouldn't be necessarily opposed to making profits off of healthcare. So I think that this, you know, it's a kind of a complicated answer, but I do think that that's important to note. I do think it's really interesting because one of the things that Bravatti briefly mentions, touches on, is that when Naqvi's Abraj went up in flames, all of its various funds were broken up and they were actually bought up by other private equity firms based in the US, and that they are actually doing good business there. I mean, I haven't followed this through. I haven't researched this claim to find out whether indeed like a KKR or whoever that came in and bought up some of these funds is actually making good money off of it. But that is the claim that Bravatti makes. So obviously it is the downfall of Abraj has been a boon to its competitors.
On this question of the investment in healthcare in Africa and elsewhere, I mean, just to play devil's advocate for a moment, if, as it were, capitalism is the only game in town and the only sources of money are going to be Abraj Capital or Bill Gates Foundation, healthcare projects need money. If these are the only sources of money, it's better than not that they're investing.
Okay, so I watch a lot of crap television. Which has a lot of advertisement attached to it. And one of the things that I've noticed in the last year or so is the extent to which private healthcare companies are advertising here in the UK, Benenden Health, whatever. And the hook that they all use in their advertising is that if you want to see a doctor within 24 hours, you can. And of course, we know that seeing your GP, your NHS GP, is within 24 hours is seeing them is almost an impossibility. You could potentially get a phone call from them, but you'd have to be at death's door or have some medical emergency in order to be able to see your GP. Now, the reason that Benenden Health, and there are a number of them that do this advertising, can do this sort of thing, is because there has been a concerted policy decision made by the Tories, starting with the austerities of George Osborne more than a decade ago, to essentially not fund the necessary expansion of an NHS that needs to increasingly serve an increasingly ill population because the population profile as a whole is becoming older and therefore susceptible to more illnesses. They've just decided to not fund that expansion. In some ways, just even holding the funding where it is and not cutting it, and there have been areas where they've cut it, But just holding the funding as it is essentially translates into an effective cut to the budget of the NHS. And so what you're doing is you're opening up a space for private healthcare in this. And I think that there has to be a recognition that a system predicated on private healthcare and private insurance is going to be a system like the US, where if you get cancer, if you don't have good healthcare, you're going to have to go online and do fundraising in small funds from friends and strangers in order to be able to pay for your cancer treatment. I mean, that's a horrifying, horrifying system if you think about it. And I think that healthcare, for example, is very, as I said, it is a human right. It should be one that is publicly funded, and that the profit motive, the calculation that goes into it, should be taken out of it. I always found it really interesting that in the US, one of the arguments against use of a public health system was that, oh my God, NHS has a death panel. But in fact, what you've got is the death panel is in the US, where the panel is simply determined by how much money you have or don't have, or what, you know, how, whether or not your insurance will cover something or not. And I think that it's really important to acknowledge that. Now, one of the other elements of this that I think is really important, and I think it has to be mentioned, is that in post-colonial Africa, there was a moment, maybe for about 30, 40 years in the immediate aftermath of decolonization, where there was an effort by those countries that were coming out of colonialism to establish public services, health, education, telecommunications, roads, other kinds of infrastructures that people need in order to survive on a day-to-day basis. There was an attempt to do so publicly, and that attempt was essentially wiped out. Why was it wiped out? Because we had, by the 1980s, the process of decolonization, political decolonization may have succeeded, but economic decolonization had not. That process essentially receded. Foreign capital came and reinvested. Foreign capital eventually gave way to local capitalists. And where public services were supposed to be publicly funded, whether that's public funding by your state or public funding by a public body outside, so let's say a World Bank that does public funding rather than private funding, or determines, you know, these kinds of neoliberal type investments. Let's say UNDP that would, for example, have funds, or an investment bank that is public funding. All of that receded in favor of privately funded services, infrastructures. I'll give you one example that is often cited as some sort of a incredible triumph of business or private infrastructure. And that is that in the entirety of the continent of Africa, people are now dependent on mobile phones for everything. In part, this has been because mobile infrastructure, mobile telephony infrastructure, is much easier to establish than cabled infrastructures, right? It's just, you don't have to dig. You could just put up a mast and it works fine. And all of that was funded by private companies. And so Kenya, for example, was one of the first places where it was really, really easy for people to have mobile phones. Now, mobile telephony meant that people were in touch. This is ostensibly a public good, right? But the problem is that public good is utilized for all sorts of things, including, for example, mobile telephony banking, which creates enormous amounts of debt. Small loans turn into massive indebtedness. It also means that your private mobile company will have inordinate control over your infrastructure. Now, This is something that needs to be thought about a lot more carefully, because internet is now as important to write, it's as important to utility for us as electricity or water. And we know here in the UK, where water has been completely privatized, we've got shit floating down the rivers. We've got all of the different water companies that are dumping water in the rivers. And while environmental activists go swimming in the Seine or swimming in the Hudson River in New York, the possibility of swimming in a British river is like, which kind of waterborne disease do you want to contract? And so we know that public utilities cannot be left to private companies. internet cannot be only handed over to a Virgin Media or to BT, because they will gouge, they will price gouge if they can. We know that this is even true with apps, because we have seen, for example, the extent to which Twitter, which used to be used for example, emergency services as a way of reaching out to their audiences if something was going wrong, has essentially been turned into a circus for blue-ticked right-wingers and has lost its utility, and I use that word intentionally. It has lost its utility as an emergency service information provider. And I think that these are the kinds of reasons why certain goods on which we are absolutely dependent cannot be left to those who'd like to extract profit out of those goods. And I think that that's part of the argument that I'm trying to make. So it's not that corruption or bad management is at stake, although there is tons of that also to go around, but that fundamentally certain services, certain sectors absolutely should not be left to profit makers.
Yeah. I mean, what you were saying earlier about the after decolonization or political decolonization in Africa, that the attempt to introduce new kinds of infrastructure, I mean, that's, and what happened to people who tried to do that. For example, you know, talking to Kevin Okos on this podcast not long ago, his piece in the LRB, if you look at Patrice Lumumba in Congo, who wanted to, well, I hesitate to say he wanted to nationalise, but any idea that the people of Congo had a right to the minerals that Belgian mining companies were extracting from their land, and Lumumba was assassinated.
Yeah, it is really fascinating for me. Another example that I write about in my Sinews book, which I think is really worth saying, is that now Lumumba was an anti-imperialist, like, right? He was a lefty, but even with allies and clients, the big European and American powers were stingy about the questions of development when they had control over those places, right? An example that I write about in my Sinews book is that Saudi Arabia had almost no roads to speak of, while Aramco, which was really basically in charge of the sort of infrastructure development in the country, while Aramco was an American-owned company. It essentially built some roads between the oil-producing region on the Gulf, so the Dammam and Dahran area, to Riyadh. A road from Riyadh to Jeddah. A railway was built between the oil-producing areas and Riyadh. A railway was bandied about between Riyadh and Jeddah, never emerged. Really, if you actually look at, there is an international body that tracks the number of miles of road each country has. It is astonishing to see that, you know, the number of miles was piddly for a country that was just huge and enormous, you know, the number of miles of road that it had, until it nationalized the oil. And then it had control over its own. And this is Saudi Arabia. It's not exactly, you know, some sort of a lefty icon of public good provision. The same was true of every single little emirate on the Gulf that the British had control of. The United Arab Emirates had a single road between Sharjah and Abu Dhabi while the British were in charge of it, and nothing else. And then as soon as, of course, the British gave their independence to these countries and oil was, some control over the oil incomes was recuperated by these little emirates, then a lot of roads were built. You see this happening again and again and again everywhere. And those developmental policies during colonization were essentially just ways to extract money out of or extract cargo or extract minerals out of these places. If there was infrastructure, Walter Rodney writes about this in Africa, where he says all of the railways led to the ports and they avoided the large cities because most of the time what the railways were built for was to go from the mining areas to the port to carry copper or iron ore or coal or whatever else it was that was being extracted to the ports to be shipped elsewhere. And so I think that that process was for a very brief time challenged, if not necessarily reversed, in the moment of decolonization. But then already in the 1950s, Nkrumah of Ghana was writing about neocolonialism and the control of foreign European, formerly colonial capital, over the same infrastructures, over the same businesses. And we see a reinstantiation, reconsolidation, strengthening of that control of the foreign capital over developmental policies of these places. And we've also seen this sort of a shift from the bigger sort of international funding bodies, investment banks, etc., from thinking that things should be publicly funded to public-private partnerships, or better yet, bring in foreign capital to do whatever they want to do because, you know, making money is better for everybody, according to them.
Yeah. I mean, that question of the railways being built in order to export extracted minerals. I mean, that's true in Wales as well, that the railways in Wales were taking coal from the mines to the ports. And actually, if you want to get a train even now from South Wales to North Wales, you have to go through England. And then that question of extracting resources. I mean, I think I was seeing something that the price of uranium in Niger since the coup, that France used to buy. I say buy, but France used to get uranium
at a discount
from Niger at a discount, shall we say? And I mean, how much has it gone up by? I mean, obviously there are other factors as well, but you know, that a country supposedly has its independence, and yet,
I mean, there's a whole series of policies that are in the bundle of developmental programs for the countries of the global south that are essentially ways to continually embed them in the system of extraction and to give unfair advantage to the former colonial masters. I think Niger actually is a really good example. I mean, there are so many of different, the franc zone, essentially, in West Africa, which are the former colonies, which are bound to France and support its currency by establishing certain financial institutions that cannot separate themselves, also means that developmental policies in those places are very much subject to the kind of monetary policies that are established because they're directed from Paris itself. It's a little bit like all of the oil money that was being produced by the countries in the Gulf and elsewhere in the 1950s and 60s, supporting the sterling at a cost to those countries themselves. So in a way, the way that the currencies in these places are set up, the way that the banks, the central banks in these places are set up, former colonies are set up. And then the developmental policies, even by well-meaning, even by left-wing developmentalists, run into problems of who does it benefit? What sorts of rules are put into place that allows for that money to be dispersed? What sorts of conditionalities go into the expenditure of that money? And, you know, and so that those kinds of conditions around the question of development also means that we don't, you know, there's a huge sort of discursive and political impetus to economically develop parts of the world that are in poverty or that are suffering from massive deprivation in social goods or social benefits. And yet the developmental policies often benefit a very thin sliver of folks there and further embed the majority of the population in relations of debt or exploitation. And I think that that's one of the things that I think I'm coming at. And I'm, again, here exaggerating, caricaturing a little bit all of development policies. But I do think that a lot of the top-down developmental policies tend to have that effect.
I mean, you write in the piece that from the start, the development finance industry resembled the US military, which is quite a striking thing to read. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
I mean, one of the things that really struck me was how many acronyms there were. And one of the things that I learned when I was writing my book on counterinsurgency about 15 years ago now was that when people use acronyms and when you are dependent on knowing what the acronyms are and what the acronyms mean and how they function, it is often because somebody is trying to hide something. The acronym hides something. It is, it's not just some mode of simplifying, shortening. It is also a way of cloaking what is at stake. So a lot of the investment agencies do the same thing. They are massive bureaucracies, again, like the US military. They are fragmented, again, like the US military. One part doesn't know what the other part is doing. They are top-heavy in certain ways in financial sense, meaning that certain centers have a huge amount of money flowing through them, whereas the people at the bottom of the pyramid tend not to have that much resources allocated to them, again, like the US military. There is a huge sort of ideological drive towards privatization, again, like the US military. And then there is, of course, the convergence between developmental and military activities in the 1960s onwards, where the idea of counterinsurgency or pacification came to absorb a lot of developmental policies. I mean, this was, of course, much older. When the French were colonizing places like Indochina or Madagascar, they believed in setting up, what would they say, roads? Schools and markets, because roads, schools and markets were the trinity of development. And it was also the way in which you incorporated, absorbed and co-opted local populations into your counterinsurgency or pacification plans. And so you find that the roads, markets and schools element also appears in U.S. counterinsurgency. So there are those convergences also between developmental policy and military policy. And I think that to me was the fact that there's so much structural similarity between these was for me something really interesting. And it was a bit of a throwaway comment, but the more I have thought about it since I wrote that piece, the more I've thought, well, actually, there's probably something to it, that there is, in some ways, developmental policies on the one hand and sort of the coercive arms of the US and NATO states on the other hand are the sort of the two arms of capital. One is coercive, one is hegemonic. That's how they function together, and essentially that between the pincer of coercion and development, you know, is called everybody else in the world.
And you mentioned the people. Well, we've talked about Congo already, but you mentioned in the piece also that Guatemala, Iran, and Chile, that countries which had democratically elected socialist leaders who wanted to nationalize their natural resources, who were overthrown in coups that were supported by the CIA and by the US in order to protect the interests of
private capital,
international capital, private capital.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's really, really important to recognize, is that sovereignty over resources has been the biggest bone of contention between the former colonial masters and the decolonizing states in the 20th century and since. I think it's really important to recognize that a lot of the mechanisms that were established by international institutions in order to sort of put their finger on the scale on behalf of private capital, everything from state investor dispute managed mechanisms to arbitration mechanisms, everything was intended to protect private capital. And where those kinds of legal mechanisms failed, then coup d'etats were very successful in a number of different places. In almost every instance in the mid-20th century where you see a coup d'etat happening, there is some element of demand to nationalize the economy or to have some sort of a sovereign control over the economy. That was pretty much the rule of the control of capital in the 20th century, and I suspect continuing on into the 21st.
I mean, you say in the piece that the debate about the balance of private and public investment in the global south has been settled in favour of private capital, and not only in the global south, right? I mean, as you've already talked about, the privatisation of utilities in the UK, and again, so-called public-private partnerships are, I mean, they're the norm now and have been since New Labour and possibly actually before that, since, you know, the major government in the 90s in health and education infrastructure. Although that, I mean, the question of where the money comes from is, I mean, something we haven't talked about yet is the amount of public money that gets funneled into private companies and the way that, I mean, you say in the piece, the question of that the risk is, the profit is private and the risk is public. That we see it with the rail companies in the UK, that they get huge subsidies from the government and they make profits and the trains don't run on time. So,
I mean, I think that that's really important, because I think that, and Brett Christopher's book really touches on that, in particular in the context of the UK, where, you know, infrastructures, the huge amounts of public investment goes into them, the private companies extract money, and then often the infrastructures fail. I mean, I don't know, I lived in Scotland in the 2000s, and I remember that some of the schools funded by New Labour under public-private partnership arrangements actually had to be shut within 10 years because their buildings were falling apart. So I think that kind of, you know, the profits are privatized and the risk is made public is one element of this. Just today, Bloomberg had published a long read, which was absolutely fascinating, which was about what they called zombie private equity. So companies that set up private equity firms that take a lot of funds and then dump their money into ventures that then they doesn't matter how much they cut to the bone or how much they disassemble it, they can't make money off of it. And then the funds that put money into those private equity companies have to, at a discount, withdraw their monies. So essentially at a loss to us, often because these are pension funds. And it was really interesting for me to see these, to see the Bloomberg write about these zombie private equity, and then to see who the biggest funders were, who were putting money in these. And it was like North Carolina state pensions or California, you know, teachers' state pensions and things like that. And so I think it is, you know, it's not only is the profit privatized, because I bet the private equity guys who were running this were making huge amounts of money and live in really lovely places in Manhattan and have, you know, a summer house in the Hamptons. But in instances where they are absolutely and utterly incompetent, also the big funders, which are, you know, the pension companies, have to eat the loss, which means we have to eat the loss. So I think, to me, that's really fascinating. And there's so little regulation of this. And now we're seeing, again, another thing that is, Bloomberg is really fabulous to read because of everything that you're seeing that, you know, that they publish. Wasn't it Chomsky or somebody who said that if they're providing news to the capitalists, their news is going to be actually reliable and dependent? And it's absolutely right. One of the other things that is really interesting to see is that apparently there is now something called private debt or private banking. And this is like private investments where there's, again, very little scrutiny, and God knows what sorts of monies these you know, investments are being made into. And then the failure of some of these investments, some of these banks, probably is going to result into them being whatever, too big to fail, and therefore being rescued by taxpayer money. I mean, it's again and again the same sorts of stuff that we see happening, and a lack of regulation and a kind of almost religious belief that somehow private capital is going to be efficient and better functioning and doing better. And it is a religious faith in this. It's there's nothing that actually bears it out other than the fact that the people that are promoting it are the ones that are making huge and rich profits off of it. It is really resulting in the devastation of the public landscape in the global south, but also in the global north where we live.
Yeah. I mean, the arrival of private money in education and health and so on. The chair that you hold at Exeter University is endowed by the Al Qasimi royal family.
Sheikh of Sharjah. Yeah, it is. And it is actually, it's as much as I am happy to bear the name, I'm supposed to say that, I guess, it is very problematic to have chairs that are, it's very American style, actually, where chairs are endowed by foreign donors. And if you think about it, part of, I have to also mention this, that thankfully, the conditions of the endowment where the Qasimis put money in are such that the chair and the department is essentially got a firewall around it, which means that the donor cannot dictate the terms of what happens. And I have absolutely no problem criticizing any of the royal families in the Gulf. But I think it is also really worth mentioning that the withdrawal of funding and in an increasing imposition, a kind of a business mentality on the job of education has translated into universities scrambling to get money from everybody, from, you know, sort of potentates sitting on a bank of cash to oil companies that are trying to greenwash their reputations through things like funding carbon capture and other kind of bullshit technologies that haven't happened yet, just so that they could claim to be doing things that are green or moving towards net zero. And so I think that is also, this is a part of the whole same process by which, by withdrawal of public funding from things that are supposed to be public goods and publicly available to the vast majority of the people, if they so choose to take, or at least all people, if they so choose to take, if they choose to take partake of it, by withdrawal of that public funding, what we're doing is we're opening up space for private funding to interfere. And some universities may not be as scrupulous about putting in that protective insulation around our research or academic freedom. Some universities will be inevitably much more vulnerable to pressure from the donors. And I think that that's really horrifying if you think about it.
Lale Khalili, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
You can read Lale's latest piece in the 7th of September issue of the LRB or in the paper's online archive. Next week on the podcast, I'll be talking to Rosemary Hill about Mount Vesuvius, so please join us for that. The LRB podcast is produced by Anthony Wilkes and Zoe Kilbourne. The music is by Kieran Brunt. I'm Thomas Jones. Thank you for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.